The value from active management on fixed income comes from really understanding what are your risks when it goes wrong. We've had a very benign credit environment for several decades now, and I think sometimes people forget that it's not a free lunch. Yep. And so I think passive for fixed income needs a lot more thought. The LGPS is still heavily invested in the UK, so about 30% of the LGPS is invested in the UK in different asset classes, which, given that the LGPS is about 400 billion, is quite a lot of money. We invest in UK real estate, some index-linked gilts, UK equities, UK credit. We have, over the last few years in particular, started to really work with our partner funds to focus on investing in the UK in private markets.
As we learned from our interviews with Ontario Teachers and the Australia Future Fund, the consolidation of pension assets into sizable pools can offer scale, access, and reach, as well as much needed capital for the domestic economy. They offer the potential to act with a very long-term horizon as long-term true asset owners and to unlock investment opportunities that individual funds might struggle to access alone. Today in the UK, one of the most consequential organisations in UK pensions is Border to Coast. They sit at the centre of one of the most significant shifts in UK institutional investing in a generation and oversee over 100 billion of local authority assets. To understand the investment approach, the motivation, the challenges and the opportunities such scale bring, we're delighted to welcome Rachel Owell, CEO of Border to Coast. Rachel, it's taken us nearly a year to pin you down, but you're here. Welcome.
Thank you. It's brilliant to be here. I'm really looking forward to it.
Great. Well, let's start with you. Cambridge, maths and statistics, 93 to 97. My wife, who studied maths over in Oxford, says that when she mentions this at drinks parties, people tend to move away. Was it a good choice?
Oh, brilliant question. Look, I had a fantastic time in Cambridge. I met some brilliant people who were lifelong friends and godparents to my children. For me, that was something I think when I was at the age of three, I asked where my dad went to university and he said Pembroke College. And I decided that that's where I was going before I even knew anything about Cambridge, which probably tells you I'm a bit of a daddy's girl. but also, you know, Pembroke didn't allow women in until 1986. So they actually had their 10-year anniversary of letting women in. So I was still confidently saying I was going to Pembroke when actually it wasn't even possible. So maybe that also says something about I like to set myself a goal and really go for it. I was very fortunate to come from a loving family who believed in the importance of education. My parents were teachers. My grandparents were a combination of teachers and managing or station master for one of the local railway stations. And I think that really gave me a sense of having had that start, how important it was to do something with that. And I think that probably then links on to some of the things that I did in my later career and what I do now.
So let's look at your career, which at the moment appears to have been in three stages, 15 years at PwC, Royal London for 6 years, and 8 years so far as CEO of Border to Coast. Let's just start with PwC, because big organization, you tend to get streamed into different things. How early were you assigned to the financial services and why?
So when I was at sixth form, I did one of those questionnaires, you know, yes, like what should you do? And it came back with engineering, teaching, or being an actuary. And I'm not very good at building things. People don't allow me to do that. Right. So engineering was never going to work. My parents fairly early on told me that I probably didn't have the patience to be a good teacher. So that left, I didn't even know what an actuary was. So when I was at university, I wrote to a number of actuarial firms and said, I don't know what an actuary is. Would you maybe let me have some summer work so I can find out? Yeah. And PwC saw something in that letter. I was their first actuarial summer student. And they were, you know, fortunate. They offered me a job after that. I guess the great thing about joining well, it was PW at the time, was that they were not a traditional actuarial consultancy. They were still growing. And so one of the first things that I did was working with the then FSA on the pensions review and looking at how should that be structured. And that kind of led me then into doing all sorts of different things with PwC across all industries. I worked heavily with transaction services, working with private equity firms. I was a scheme actuary for Tetley T. But I think increasingly got involved in doing new things. So when the pensions regulator was brought in, I was very involved in working out how you thought about those moral hazard clauses in doing a deal, for example. I then had some maternity leaves, and by this stage I'd moved back up home to Yorkshire. Coming back from that, I thought, actually, what do I want to do next? And that's, I'd been there by that stage, if you include my summer student role, for 17 years, but I'd been through so many different phases of my career, even though I'd been there that long. Every 3-4 years, I was doing something mm-hmm. different. I think probably the highlight of my years at PwC was I was seconded to the Russian government and worked with them on their pension reform. That was just after I'd qualified as an actuary. So I was out there for about 8 months. And that was absolutely fascinating, but just really gave me that sense of how you go into a totally alien situation and apply what you know, work with the people there and bring that together.
Right. And so the Royal Lantern, which was the stint in between, what was it that you thought was going to give you didn't have?
Another part of the story for me is the people that you meet as you are working. So the story with Royal London was I was looking about what the next stage of my career would be, and I'd been working with the then FD at Royal London and really enjoyed the relationship that I had with him. And this was at a time when Royal London were very acquisitive and were looking to consolidate the mutual insurance industry. And he invited me to come and help him to do that with the pension schemes. So I went across to Royal London. I set up their pensions team on the staff pension side. But then that led to other things. So I set up the group treasury function. I established the investment office. So I was the person at the insurance company who was the biggest client for Royal London Asset Management business at that time. And I think having people who see something and give you the opportunity and the support to do that has been a really important theme, both for me personally, but then I hope how I want to work with other people.
Schroders Capital is the private markets division of Schroders, combining the experience, the specialized local teams with the scale, rigor, and resources of a global institutional platform. Schroders Capital provide its clients with global access to differentiated and specialized strategies encompassing all private markets asset classes, from private equity to real estate, infrastructure, and the broad universe of private debt and credit alternatives. This approach enables Schroders Capital to access opportunities and investments that are often difficult to find elsewhere, while also having the broad capabilities and perspectives needed to build holistic solutions and deliver tailored outcomes across private markets for both institutional and wealth clients. Discover more at schroderscapital.com. Remember, capital is at risk with investing. IFM Investors is a global asset manager, founded and owned by pension funds with capabilities in infrastructure, equity and debt, private equity, private credit, and listed equities. They believe healthy returns depend on healthy economic, environmental, and social systems, and these are evolving on a scale never experienced before. To find opportunity, build value, and meet the needs of future generations, you need scale, skill, and expertise. That's what IFM Investors has built up over 30 years. Which brings us to your role as CEO of Border to Coast. Huge job, huge challenge. Can we start with a description of why it's been created, and what it is today.
So local government pension scheme, when you think about it as a whole, is one of the largest pension schemes globally. It's in the top 10, and depending on what's happening with market prices, possibly top six. When we think about how it's administered, across the whole of the UK, there are over 100 administering authorities, each managing that in small or large individual schemes, administering the same benefit structure. But you have from the Isle of Wight, which is under £1 billion of assets under management sterling, to Greater Manchester Pension Fund, which is over £30 billion. And so about 12 years ago, then Chancellor George Osborne talked about how can we harness this scale in a different way. So he said to the LGPS in England and Wales, go away and create half a dozen asset pools. At the time, they were referred to as sovereign wealth funds, but clearly they're not. They are pension funds. Yeah. And their purpose is to make sure that the investments that are needed to support the benefits within the local government pension scheme can be run well, and that we can harness the benefits of scale. Even back then, over 10 years ago, part of that policy intent was, how can we work with these large asset owners to invest into infrastructure in the UK? So that's, I think, always been a thread through the last decade. Obviously, in the last few years, that's become more prominent again, just like it has for the whole of that asset owner in the UK. I think at the heart of this, the local government pension scheme has nearly 7 million members. The average member is a 47-year-old woman working part-time, earning £19,000. The average pension is about £5,000 a year. And I think for the UK, it's serving a number of different policy initiatives, the most important of which is for low earners, it's providing a secure income incredibly cost effectively. So it costs less than half of what it would if we were trying to provide this through a defined contribution plan, partly because you can pool the investment risk and the life mortality risk. And I think that is sometimes we can get wrapped up in, is defined benefit a good thing or a bad thing? But actually, if you look at that in the system in the UK, the LGPS does that very, very well. I think the other bit that we sometimes miss is that income is the difference for these individuals between having provided for their own and contributed to their own retirement versus it being means tested. And there's plenty of information out there about what that means psychologically for people, that they've made their own security.
Right, right.
So I think for me, going back to when I was growing up and what I found important, the great thing about Border to Coast is that it has that purpose that is really important for the individuals, for local communities, for taxpayers, whilst also being really fascinating intellectually, and allowing me to grow and develop and do new things within our industry.
Okay, so purpose is clear, economic logic is clear. Let's move to the investment equation. The most difficult question, they say, are the simplest ones. Is there a single unifying investment objective?
So I talked about there being over 100 administering yes. authorities, and they all have different investment beliefs, risk appetites. They're starting from different places. Some of them are well-funded. Others, are still looking for that investment return to be above 100%. Although the recent valuation, the LGPS is more than 100% funded on right. on the whole. And the vast majority of those administering authorities have funds that are more than 100% funded. So what that means in reality is we have, or will have, from the 1st of April with the consolidation that we've seen just recently, 18 of these pension funds who we are providing investment services to. And each of those 18 have their own investment beliefs and objectives. Part of our job is to work with them to help make sure that they are clearly articulated, and then to provide advice on how they might invest to support their objectives in line with their beliefs.
So in investment parlance, does that make the investment advisor, not the investment manager?
Well, we do both. And actually, when I say we do both, we will do both, because this is a big part of the recent changes. Right. So historically, when we first started pooling, we had just the investment implementation part of that process. So that meant, if we go back to 8 years ago, we were working very hard, small team in Leeds, looking to create a regulated asset manager. We went live at the end of June 2018 with the first transition of assets of about 10 billion to manage equities in-house, both UK and overseas developed markets. And the journey from then has been to build out those capabilities. A couple of years ago, we knew that we were coming towards the end of building those capabilities. So we worked with those partner funds to say, what do you want us to do next? You've built and you've had the vision to build this centre of expertise in Leeds with in-house investment management expertise, as well as partnering with external managers. What do you want us to do next? And that ended in our 2030 strategy, which thinks about the funds as being holistic. Partner fund pensions committees set the strategy and the risk return appetite. Border to Coast implements that. We have investment reporting that enables the funds to oversee, but importantly to feed back into how they set the strategy. We've got strong oversight and governance in place, as you would expect. And then making sure that in any system, only being as strong as its weakest link, that everybody really understands and their role is valued in that system. And so we agreed this strategy and what we needed to build. That was signed off by our shareholders, who are our partner funds, in August 2024. And then in November 2024, the government launched their LGPS Fit for the Future consultation,
Right. Which
took our 2030 strategy to needing to be delivered by April 2026. So by April 2026, the key elements of that system will by and large be in place.
And merging disparate pools of capital is a challenge that investment organizations face, you know, when they go through change. Give some practical illustrations of, you know, both the challenges and where you've learned how to do this better.
So I think going back to, maybe that comes back to, why did I take the job? Mm-hmm. And I suppose the first one of these, I talked about really enjoying creating things. And this is such a brilliant opportunity to create something that's, you know, is meaningful. In Leeds, which is, you know, where I'm from, or at least I should say I'm from Sheffield, which is very important for those people who are from Yorkshire to make that distinction.
Okay.
But I grew up near Leeds. So being able to contribute to what's already a very strong financial services economy with building an investment manager in Leeds was, you know, really intellectually challenging and also close to my heart. But I suppose historically, my leadership roles have probably been more technical. And I think what was really interesting about this role, on top of all of the other things I've just talked about, is the chance to work with people who don't have to do something and don't necessarily want to do it. And how do you create an environment where people feel ownership of what's being created and feel that they have a really strong voice in what's being created, and I hope feel proud of what's being created? So that might sound like a very long-winded answer to, again, what might be a simple question. Originally, bringing together the 11 they'd already decided that they wanted to work together. And, you know, that meant that I could come in and talk to them about facilitating that. And I think there, you know, there's some really important themes when you're pooling. One of those is, what's the cost of compromise? So if partners come into that very fixed on what they already have and all of the detail of it, it's almost impossible to pool.
Yep.
So really working hard on how different are you to another partner? If we put those things together, we can get these benefits of scale, and actually the compromise isn't big. So we had I'll give you an example just to bring it to life, I hope. Investment grade credit, an asset class very close to my heart, partly because I'm very good at it. And so I got brilliant opportunity to work with that team when I was there. We had this really fascinating discussion about whether there is a difference between buy and maintain and low turnover active on investment grade credit. And when you really get down to it, they're not that different, particularly in a vehicle that's pooled where the pension schemes are continuing to put money in. But the terminology of that had really grabbed people's attention. So we had to work on, what do we really mean by these things, these phrases that people are using, and how do you get people to see that actually they're really not that different? Here's the benefit that you get if you come together.
Can you just break those two? Because actually, as you said that, and I think I understand things think well quite well, I was thinking, hang on, do I understand that distinction? So help me.
Yeah. So people will talk about buy and maintain or buy and hold. It's really a concept in the insurance market when you're backing, liabilities that are really not changing, and you want to buy fixed income that will really match those liabilities. That's a phrase that people have adopted and brought into the pension world, but it's not really. Insurance and pensions have some similarities, but they're not the same. And but I think people who had heard that idea of buy, maintain, or buy and hold had got the idea this is a way of harnessing fixed income without having to pay the costs of continuing to actively manage your portfolio. Low turnover active is sort of the same thing. You know, you're actively managing a portfolio, but you're not seeking to turn it over. And you know, for investment grade credit, those turnover costs can be quite high. So the people here were really committed to that because they saw that that was a way of managing the portfolio actively, but without a lot of trading costs. And the people in the buy and maintain strategy had definitely heard this is a really low cost way of managing fixed income, but they hadn't appreciated that they were basically just the same phrases for the same portfolio.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about some of those investment strands, but since we're talking about fixed income, investment grade, straightforward, explosion in the last two decades around private credit, with its attendant risks and rewards. And someone like myself would have been arguing for a while that there's been too much enthusiasm and disappointment is the natural contour in this space. How do you think about that as an asset allocation level?
So we have to bear in mind that it's not been the pool's job to decide whether how much funds want to have in private credit. It's been the pool's job to date to talk, you want to have private credit in your allocation. You've been advised by your consultants or other advisors about the structure to have. How can we most safely deliver that asset in the way that you've envisaged it in your strategy? And so we engaged with our partner funds on, what are you looking for? What sort of return do you need to meet your strategic objectives? Actually, you don't need to go after some of the riskier end of the private credit market. You can see that as a diversifier, a source of income. You are long-term asset owners, so you can bear the liquidity risk and hopefully harness a liquidity premium. Debatable, obviously, in private markets, whether that exists. Mm-hmm. But trying to make sure that we are working with in the case of private credit, we do that in partnership with typically with GPs to make sure that the way that those portfolios are constructed are managing the risks and are at the that less risky end of the market, which I think will serve us well as we see this current phase play out.
I'm thrilled to share that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by the World Gold Council. They champion the role gold plays as a strategic asset through expert research, commentary, and insights. And it's not just your portfolio that may benefit from gold. Learn how gold mining is supporting female economic empowerment and small businesses via their new documentary series called Gold, The Journey Continues. Tap the link in the show notes to start watching. I'm excited to announce that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, known as LSEG. At the heart of the global economy, LSEG provides data, analytics, and infrastructure that connects investors, businesses, and economies. LSEG is where ideas meet capital, enabling sustainable growth and opportunity. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more. Which then, of course, takes us to the two levels of to insource versus to outsource and to be passive versus active. We've had a lot of conversation with, you know, Manny Roman at PIMCO and, you know, various others about just how active does outperform passive in the world of fixed income, but equally there are costs and, you know, these sound simpler questions than of course they are, but just, you know, just let me understand how you think about approaching those two topics.
So, let's start with active versus passive because it's a really hot topic.
Yep.
And I think historically the LGPS has had significant proportions of its assets in public markets.
Yep.
So I think it's important that we think about fundamentally at the heart of it, what are you trying to achieve with your investment strategy over time? And what's the best way of accessing that in the market? So I think when we talk about the active versus passive, we can sometimes get caught into, have you under or outperformed a market in the short term? If you are a long-term asset owner, you're actually wanting to manage long-term risks. There are times when passive management is a really important tool to have in your toolbox, but there are also recognition that being passively managed and not thinking about what's happening with that underlying benchmark can send you on a journey that is increasingly concentrated. And we've probably seen a bit of that in the equity markets recently. But it's not, I don't think it's right to sit here and say active is always better than passive. And we can clearly see that over a fairly long period if you look at equity markets. So if you think about we want to get exposure to a given market, and then what's the right best way of doing that? For equity markets, we still see that there is value in being actively managed, particularly around those long-term risks, or about diversification between countries and geographies. But we also think that there are efficient ways of accessing that. And we would want to give our partner funds diversified exposure to it. So we would have a blend of working with some specialist managers externally, partnering with them. I'll come back to when we decide how to do that. We have our in-house team that is actively managing, great track record, slightly more benchmark aware, being able to manage those long-term risks. And then we'll also have some more index strategies, whether that's smart beta or market cap. But if you look at fixed income, I mean, there are ways of constructing indices to avoid this, but it's very basic level. You are investing into the most indebted companies if you do it passively. And I think the value from active management on fixed income comes from really understanding what are your risks when it goes wrong. We've had a very benign credit environment for several decades now, and I think sometimes people forget that it's not a free lunch. Yep. And so I think passive for fixed income needs a lot more thought, especially when we I think there is generally recognition that what we've had for the last couple of decades, for many, many reasons, is not necessarily what we're going to be seeing for this next 10 years.
So the other thing that intrigued me when I went through the portfolio construction was this UK versus global, because there, we know what's happened to UK weightings in indices and all sorts of the factors that, in other words, might not have driven down the weighting that, that is represented. But there is a sense that you're also acting as a source of domestic capital as well. And we've now got this US with this extraordinary overweight in stock markets that if history is any lesson, you know, we know that the next big move will be down, not up, but the US is a percent of the weight. Maybe I'm again revealing my ancient history. But how do you balance what I imagine is a tension?
So, great question. The LGPS is still heavily invested in the UK. So about 30% of the LGPS is invested in the UK in different asset classes, which, given that the LGPS is about 400 billion, is quite a lot of money. I think, first of all, giving the actuarial answer, our liabilities are in sterling. We are quite interested in what's happening with home inflation and you know, being able to pay liabilities that are sterling based. But we are also a very large investor, so we need to be well diversified across all different kinds of risks, which is why I think, to your point around country diversification, when you're a very long-term investor, do you need to capture all of the upside if you can give that long-term stable return that will enable the contributions to be stable and affordable? In terms of the UK specifically, we invest in UK real estate, some index-linked gilts, but not a lot because the LGPS is open and is a seeker of growth, UK equities, UK credit. And we have, over the last few years in particular, started to really work with our partner funds to focus on investing in the UK in private markets.
Right.
So we launched a fund a couple of years ago, which we call UK Opportunities. There we are looking for things to invest in across the capital stack, but that are additive. So they're looking to bring in new energy opportunities, to do some regeneration of a place, to invest in small and medium enterprises that will create jobs. And that's something that our partner funds are particularly engaged in. If we get that right together, and I don't think this is just about the LGPS or our partner funds, but actually the industry as a whole, then it's possible for us to have a win for members and local taxpayers and employers in terms of return, a win for the communities. And, you know, that means a win for the UK more generally. But it's still, I think, quite a nascent industry. And so I asked our partner funds, I said, look, I think this is a 10-year strategy, but I would like us to start somewhere, and it would be helpful to work with you to be able to engage with the parties in the industry to really start to test and build that. And that's also been a part of the work that I've been doing across the industry through the Investment Association and through the roles that I've had providing a voice with government about the development of policy over the last 4 or 5 years.
Okay, and clearly infrastructure is an important part of the overall asset allocation, a very important part of, you know, what the UK needs to do. We both know Luba Nicolina from IFM, and she did have a question, which was, what do you think are the key ingredients for building a successful strategic partnership between an asset owner and an asset manager?
It's a great question. Thanks, Luba. So I think one of the themes that I think is really important as part of this wider consolidation of the asset owner pensions industry in the UK is that as you create these bigger pools, you can bring in more investment expertise, which means that the partnership that you need with the asset management industry and that you can have with the asset management industry is more peer-to-peer. Now, my view is that that leads to a stronger investment in management industry because you have clients who are able to really challenge you on how to be more innovative and to really think about what you're doing and how that meets the needs of the beneficiaries and the asset owners. That means, though, that the way that the investment industry is engaging with the asset owner industry, and this is not just for ourselves or the local government pension scheme, but you can look at Nest. You can look at what's happening in the consolidation within defined contribution, many examples of that. It requires much more of a partnership approach, thinking about that long term. How do our strategy and the strategy of our partners support each other so that we've got real alignment of interest?
Which, of course, brings us to talent and location. You're in Leeds, not Edinburgh or London, in terms of its historical financial expertise. How have you gone about attracting human capital, retaining human capital, finding human capital?
So I suppose the first thing I would say is Yorkshire's an absolutely brilliant place to live.
Right.
And, you know, the cost of living, the lifestyle that you can have there is significantly different to being in London. Yep. And I know because I've lived in both.
Of course.
And I think it's brilliant that I get people dropping me a note on LinkedIn saying, you know, can I have a job? I'd like to come home. So I think there is a sense for people about Yorkshire that is a, you know, that's a real thing. Being able to do that for a truly national organization, we're not just investing in Yorkshire, I think has been a real privilege. The reality of this is, Leeds is a very strong financial services industry. You know, historically, that's where things like the cooperative movement and the mutual movement were flourishing. It has strong lawyers. It has strong consultants. What it didn't have was an investment manager. But in terms of the skills and understanding of financial services, I think you've seen that there's recognition of that in other announcements that have been made, such as Bank of England, the National Wealth Fund, you know, FCA, HMRC. There's a lot of places looking to build in that, what has been now been termed as the Northern Square Mile.
Right.
So I think from that perspective, very well connected. It's only a couple of hours down to London. It's only a few hours up to Edinburgh. The reality is that I have been blessed with this heritage from our partner funds at South Yorkshire, East Riding, Teesside, had investment teams, and they transferred into the new organisation that was Border to Coast. That gave me a core. I then have, I guess, brought in people into leadership roles and other roles, but they have really bought into helping young people or new people into the industry to develop. So a really important part of the Border to Coast ethos is that idea of investing and learning and growing. And one of the first things that I did was to create a graduate scheme.
Right.
Probably sooner than anybody would necessarily have thought, given all of the other priorities, but finding people who've got that 4 to 6 year experience is tricky when you're not here in a like that real hub. So really early on, bringing on that graduate scheme. And then last year, we also brought in an apprenticeship scheme, which I'm super proud of. And I think as we've grown and people have seen and hear about what a great place it is to work, it attracts more people who want to, absolutely, they want to be doing the investment, but they also really believe in helping the next level of talent come through.
And look, it's got to be better for the UK that we have these, you know, that we have this expertise, if that's not too grand a word, you know, distributed. One of the criticisms of the sort of, and I'm going to say the local government schemes, but they're not alone, is they've been overly obsessed with costs to the detriment of performance after costs. And that obviously shines a spotlight on sometimes the less liquid areas or the hedge fund areas, or, you know, I think under the Manchester House of Courts, et cetera, there's a shift in thinking. But just, is that a fair criticism?
So my partner funds have always thought about value, not about cost. Now, the lived reality of pooling is that it should deliver cost savings. Mm-hmm. And it's been important that we've been able to talk about those cost savings, particularly because the LGPS were investing in creating this centre of expertise for themselves. So they do want to see some return on that. And, you know, ultimately we will stand or fail by our long-term investment performance, not by how much it's cost. But in the short term, and particularly when we had the lower yields, costs were a driver in that too. So making sure that we are doing this well, efficiently, thoughtfully, we can be answerable to the public about the costs that we generate. That is important, but it has to be seen in the wider value for money. Are we delivering the long-term investment return?
And when you think about the outsourcing, you have the virtue of being long-term. Our industry is given to talking that story, but acting otherwise. And then you think about the sort of that whole external manager selection process where disappointing periods are as night follows day. How do you talk to your team about those, you know, about what is remains? People love to think investing industry is, you know, straightforward. It's not. It's really hard.
Yeah. So you asked me the question earlier and I didn't come back to it. So maybe this is a good time to. I think the first thing is when we're thinking about whether something is insourced or outsourced, it's not just about cost. It clearly can't be. Risk, that's what we do, isn't it? Our business is managing risk. But that's not just the investment risk. It's the operational risk. It's the regulatory risk. It's the people risk. And ultimately, investment management is absolutely a people business at the heart of it. So we have a clear framework that we work through when we come to a new mandate or asset class opportunity to think through all of those things to make a recommendation and a decision about whether we want to be internal or external. At the heart of that is this, what are the necessary resources to be able to manage the risk? And can we find those safely, cost-effectively? And so that's been a big driver of our thinking, and not just thinking about the whole of the asset class as a plug and play, but real estate's a really great example. The investment process breaks down into a number of different chunks. You don't have to outsource all of it. There are elements that you can do in-house safely, and there are elements that are better to be outsourced. In terms of in the inevitable, when we have decided to work with external managers, no active manager is outperforming all the time. If they were, then there'd be something
wrong.
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, we seek to build long-term relationships with our external managers. We are wanting to understand whether they are doing the mandate that we've asked them to do. If they are continuing to operate that mandate and it's going through a period where that's not performing against its benchmark, that can be explained. What's really worrying is when they start to deviate from that, or they look like they're chasing to catch up, and having that safety that they know that they're keeping on talking to us, we can understand that, should mean that we can go through those ups and downs in a way that might be trickier if you're being driven by very short-term oversight. But it's really important that we understand what the drivers of that performance are when we're making those decisions.
And we started this conversation by referencing Canada and Australia's consolidation around their, you know, those pension assets. And then people do forget the UK is the second largest pension pool in aggregate in the world. Have you been able to study, observe, and learn from any of what one might term best practice in those places?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm fortunate because I've worked in the industry for longer than obviously it looks like I have.
not as long as me.
But so I already had a really good sense and network across that peer group. But I think the brilliant thing about working in the asset owner industry is that we are not in competition with each other. We want each other to succeed. So the welcome that we've had from, you know, absolutely the Canadians, the Australians, but also the Dutch and the Nordics, they've all got significant experience. So one of the things that we did really early on was we spoke to asset owners across around 10 or 11 different retirement systems. What can we learn from you? What went wrong? What went really well? What should we do? What should we be aware of? And it, you know, if anyone's ever really interested in that, there's a report on our website. It really helped to flag some of the things that we embedded into how we work. So for example, how do you engage with your people? How do you tell the story of why what we're doing is really important and a bit different, and who would that appeal to? How do you work with your stakeholders so that they really understand what you're doing? Where are the pitfalls when you're creating or changing a system? The importance of thinking of the fund holistically and not trying to break it up into different bits and not allow those pieces to learn from each other. So I think at the beginning, that was really embedded into what we do. Latterly, we're getting to this next stage of our development. Over the next few years, we'll be growing from around 55 billion of assets under management to over 110 billion. That scale enables us to move into the next stage of the things that we can do, the resources that we'll have available to us, the capabilities. So that's when you can really start to look at how the Australians and the Canadians thought about how they harness that scale, what lessons have they learned from that, and how can we not make the same ones.
Now, there'll be a lot of people beating the paths to your door. This is a large pool of assets, etc. That's not a new phenomenon, but it's, you know, in a world of eager investment talent, they are, you know, they'll want to talk to the consumers of that capital. How do you manage just that process of filtering?
So, you know, we are really conscious of the role that we can play in supporting the UK in this actually really critical part of the UK economy. So right from the beginning, we've wanted to be very open about how you can work with us, how the sorts of things we're looking for. Right at the beginning, we had open days. I'm sure we were funding LNER for a while because we were inviting the asset management industry to come up to Leeds and, you know, engage with us. And we could say, this is what we're looking for. This is how you work with us. So I think part of managing that is being really clear with the industry how to engage. We can't take meetings with everybody. Yeah. The team are too busy. So if we can be really clear about the sorts of mandates we have and how you can share your ideas with us, and we can then reach out to those where that's a good fit, that I think is that right balance between open and transparency, which comes from being public sector, and that's a really important principle, and not just spending all of our time in sales meetings.
A couple of outsider questions. One from Will Campion, my business partner, on UK infrastructure, which is so needed, and yet one has the impression, because of planning restrictions and all sorts of other obstacles, that it sounds more appetizing than it is easy to affect. What's your observation?
Well, it's clear that there's a heck of a lot that's needed to be invested in the UK by way of infrastructure. Anybody who's lived in the north knows just how bad the northern railway network is. So that there's obviously a need for the capital. I think the real challenge is how to create the structures and the opportunities that that capital can be deployed into. And, you know, a big discussion over the last few years has been, this is not that the capital doesn't want to invest in the UK, whether it's UK capital, UK asset owners, or indeed international asset owners coming in. So then absolutely things like planning permission might be part of that. But we also have the reality that public-private partnerships have not always worked well in the UK. There are big brains putting their thinking caps on to how to create those structures that enable asset owners to be able to put their capital to work. We have to really start somewhere. And we've made some great investments into things like life sciences facilities, supporting new companies or companies that need more capital to grow. But there's definitely more that can be done in this area.
I've got a question from Richard Tomlinson, who's CIO of LPPBI, relating again to leads. And he was particularly interested in, you know, your ability to identify and retain talent and what is the talent specifically that you want to attract there?
Why do people want to work in Leeds? Because it's a fantastic place to be, really buzzy, lots of investment, lots of new things happening. From a university perspective, there's over 70,000 students, six universities just within Leeds, and that's without looking across the wider north and northeast. So brilliant pipeline of talent, a strong financial services sector already existing. The element that perhaps historically has been missing is the investment side of it. But with ourselves, with the National Wealth Fund, with the recent announcement around the UK investment team, though, there's a recognition and a growing recognition that Leeds is actually another hub for financial services and investment.
So the world of AI and the words around AI are bandied with great ease, but with great, I suspect, inaccuracy, given the unknown unknowns, to quote Donald Rumsfeld. Are there any ways in which you are practically deploying AI where you are seeing it help your investment process?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, at the heart of the investment process are people making decisions based on many, many different inputs and their experience. So AI can support the people in doing that. It can help to create research packs, give people starter for 10, help refine the communication of what people are doing. But my personal view is that certainly the lived experience of AI hallucinating or not being able to see the whole picture, it definitely is an aid and a support for our teams, but it's not something that I would see as replacing those teams. One of the things that being able to do the investment management in-house has enabled us to do is to create an in-house research capability, which is also the way that we are training the future talent and investment managers or portfolio managers of the future. And so I see them using AI to support their learning and their growth, but it's still a very important part of the process that is done in partnership.
Oh, that's very honest. And we are going to do one episode where I think we're going to take six investment managers and allocators and ask them for very succinct answers you've just given of how is it helping? Is it helping? Or actually, what is excluded? You know, so more to follow on that. Four closing questions. What's the piece of investment content or research that's your must read every week?
So at the risk of sounding a little bit like I'm bigging up my investment team, we have a weekly email where the whole team contributes to one of our investment leaders who does a brilliant job of curating it. Anything that they've seen that really captured their imagination, and that could be a podcast, or it could be an article in The Economist, or it could be some research coming from across the industry. And it's a cracky read.
Okay, well, fantastic. Well, you mentioned podcasts. I'm clearly not going to say anything that reflects self-interest, but one stat that absolutely amazed me is that 1 billion people a month watch podcasts on YouTube. Yeah. Such is the change in consumption. How do you relax?
I listen to the Rest is History podcast.
Okay, well, there you go. One more for Goal Hanger. And what irritates you most about the investment business?
So I think one of the irritating things is that we have created an industry or a society that is so risk averse that we stop seeing the wood for the trees. People think that cash is less risky, but it's not less risky when you've got high inflation. And you know, people think that passive is less risky because you don't underperform a passive index, you know, unless it's operational risk. Whereas actually, if what you're trying to do is manage long-term risk, passive can lead you down a much more risky route. So people not seeing the bigger picture or the system because they're getting caught in the minutiae, I think that is something that all of us need to work hard on.
What a great place to stop. I mean, I'd love to conclude when we've had these conversations. In fact, if I was only going to take one thing, it would be what you've just said. And Dame Julia Hoggett talked about this as well, is the greatest risk is risk aversion. By not taking risk, you actually endanger the very asset pool, pension, small savings that you wish to grow. Number one. Number two, for somebody who said at the beginning that you were no engineer, I would say that you are engineering an enterprise very successfully and putting it together. So maybe you should review that bit of your CV. And I think thirdly is that apart from the importance of this fast pool of capital that is growing to be able to serve the UK and serve its beneficiaries in a meaningful way, is I think there is also a recognition that in the past, costs have perhaps weighed too much of an importance in the investing equation. And it is for us all in the investing business, performance after cost that really matter, for particularly in some parts of the portfolio that, you know, that maybe people will run shy of. So, Rachel, thank you. It's taken a year, but we've been delighted to have you here today.
Thank you, Simon. I've really enjoyed it.